From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coronavirus hospitalizations, not just positive tests, have now reached record highs in Arizona, Arkansas, California, the Carolinas, Tennessee, and Texas. We'll speak with the mayor of Austin in just a few minutes about what's happening there.
Meanwhile, the governors of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut announced today that visitors from states with high COVID rates have to quarantine for 14 days. Dr. Amish Adalja is an infectious disease doctor and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health and Security. Doctor, your thoughts on what you're seeing?
What we're seeing now is what we've been seeing for some time, this heterogeneous nature of this outbreak, where there are certain states where cases are rising, where the percent positivity of tests are rising, and where we're seeing increasing numbers of hospitalizations. And I think this is what we're going to expect. This isn't on a single time scale. And there are places that achieved great control of this virus in some parts of the country and other parts where the virus is kind of continuing to spread at a rate that is alarming. And what we're going to need to do is keep a very strong eye on hospital capacity and our ability of health departments to contact trace to make sure that we can actually handle those cases. And there are places like Arizona and parts of Texas where we are getting worried about hospitals getting inundated with patients. And we want to make sure that we recommend people continue to social distance in those areas where we think that the community spread is at a level that really is compromising hospital function.
We'll talk about those record high hospitalizations. Is that people traveling or not wearing masks, or were these cases lying in wait? You know, they were going to happen anyway. You know, it's not just testing positive. And, you know, the president has said testing makes the numbers go up. It's not just the testing. These are serious illnesses.
Yes. When you're talking about hospitalizations, those are people that are needing oxygen, needing medical care. Maybe some of them are getting put into the ICU, put on mechanical ventilators. So these are cases that we want to avoid from happening. And what we think is happening is likely multifactorial. It is that people are socially interacting. You have to remember that just because a stay-at-home order isn't in place doesn't mean the virus isn't there. And you still have to take precautions to try and avoid becoming infected with this or spreading this. So the fact is that the virus didn't go anywhere. And I think that's what's lost on a lot of people, is that they were really looking at their state or their county going green or being open as a green light. And it's not really a green light. It just means that the hospital capacity, contact tracing ability, diagnostic testing is in a much better place so that we can better handle these cases now in June of 2020 than we could in March of 2020. And we're right. going to be dealing with these types of flare-ups in different parts of the country at different times until there is a vaccine. So we have to find a way to do this in a way that's not allowing the virus to spread rampantly and compromise our hospitals on the one hand, and trying to realize that people are going to want to get back to their lives. And I think it's not an easy balance that you have to strike. And I think that people have to really be informed about what actions are they can take to minimize their risk. And it's not going to be something that has any black or white answers. It's going to be a lot of gray, and we're going to be dealing with cases for the foreseeable future, hopefully at a manageable level.
You make such a great point, though, that the fact that there may be loosening of restrictions does not at all mean the virus has gone away. It means that things like social distancing and masking have helped contain the number of cases and people who have gotten very sick. It's still there. It's still there and will be there. So Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top doctor on this, testified on Capitol Hill yesterday. He says we are doing more testing, not less, after President Trump's claim that he had requested less testing. But the purpose of testing is to trace people who may be infected and try to get them to stay at home. We're hearing in states like Utah, the tracers are overwhelmed. How concerned are you about that?
And that's the main thing I am actually concerned about, is when you have a lot of cases occurring in a very short period of time, contact tracing ability at health departments, which are chronically under-resourced and undervalued by local and state governments, aren't able to keep track of those cases. And then you get these unrecognized chains of transmission that end up putting people in the hospital and compromising hospitals. So as we move forward, the way to get back to a closer to normal life as we can is to make sure that we have contact tracers that can get every case report, talk to that person, figure out who their contacts were, and then decide which contacts had significant exposure, and then give them protective actions to kind of quarantine for 14 days. That's how the countries that succeeded early on, like Taiwan and South Korea, did it. If you can do that, then you can kind of have some semblance of normality. But the fact was, we kind of squandered that opportunity in January and February and most of March, and we got to a place where we could actually do this now in June. but we want to make sure that we have enough contact tracers to do it. And I think that you're seeing a hodgepodge across the country with some states not able to hire enough contact tracers. And if that's the case, we will see problems arise. So I think it's really important to make sure that contact tracing is adequately supported in all 50 states. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Amesh Adalja, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health and Security. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Texas is one of the states seeing a significant spike. Governor Greg Abbott said yesterday COVID-19 is spreading at an unacceptable rate. We're joined now via Skype by Austin's mayor, Steve Adler, a Democrat. Mayor, welcome.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for the invite.
Well, and Dr. Fauci told Congress yesterday that the next 2 weeks are going to be critical in Texas as we see cases growing. What are you doing to restrict the spread of the disease over the next 2 weeks?
Well, we're trying to change the culture and the conduct and the behavior in the city. We're trying to get people now to be much more diligent about wearing masks and doing the 6-foot distancing. You know, we were doing pretty good for a while, and then the governor started opening up the economy, took away the ability for cities to be able to enforce masking. And even though the governor encouraged people to continue masking and distancing, the message got confused and the discipline went away.
Do you think that the governor ought to do a statewide mandatory mask regulation at this point?
I think the governor should do a mandatory mask. He said that he doesn't want to do it statewide because there are parts of the state that he doesn't believe it would be appropriate. If he felt that way, I wouldn't mind him doing it in parts of the state. He has that ability as well. And just the messaging from the governor that this was important enough for him to mandate it, I think would be real effective and helpful messaging.
Why do you think there has been such growth in the number of cases and hospitalizations in Texas over the last few weeks? Do you think it's because of the reopening? Do you think it's because of the protest? Do you think it's because of people just not wearing masks or what?
I think it's the behavior has changed. I think there are a lot more close physical interactions between people. When you have that, the virus transfers. I think in part that happened because of the Memorial Day holiday, but I think it's also happened because we've opened up the economy and we have more people around other people. Anecdotally, we're not seeing a lot from the demonstrations right now, and that could be because almost all the demonstrators were wearing masks.
One of the things that we're seeing in the city of Austin is that Hispanic patients are making up 60% of hospitalizations in your county, even though they only account for about 32% of the population in Austin. Why do you think the problem is so much worse for Latinos?
You know, I think it's one of the cruel aspects of this virus is that it seeks out people that are most susceptible. And that's true of our Hispanic and Latinx population, beginning with the fact that they've now gone through generations of not having the same quality health care and access to fresh foods and the like. That's the institutional racism that's really come to the forefront here in nationally in the conversations. It's also because a disproportionate number of people in that community are our economic first responders. They're the people that don't have the ability to be able to stay home and work. It's the people that have had to be out stocking shelves. And these are people that just can't stay home. And therefore, they're putting themselves at greater risk. And then finally, I think a lot of people in that community, a disproportionate number, are living in households that are cross-generational. Mm-hmm. Or they're living in a family unit that's more susceptible.
Do you see a return to shelter at home or shutting businesses back down again in Austin?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think that's ultimately a decision that the community is going to have to make. We're looking at the modeling right now, and if we continue on the current trajectory that we're on, my fear is that we may face that decision in the next 2 to 4 weeks because there's such a lag time. So you have to act early, but we're going to have to see really where the community will is. This is not so much about orders at that point, I think, as it is a community deciding what's right for them. If the governor's not going to let us do that, we can still make that choice.
As you're dealing with this spike there in Austin, and then you look on television and you see the president holding a big rally in Arizona, and a lot of people there are not wearing masks, and the president's not wearing a mask, and he's calling coronavirus the Kung Flu. What do you think when you see that?
I think that the president's messaging on this virus is one of the chief causes for the spread of the virus in my community and in my state, because it sends a confused and incorrect message. It is very difficult to watch because I know the impact that it's having on the ground in my community. I think it's irresponsible, the messaging that's coming from the president with respect to this virus. And it is one of the biggest challenges that we have here locally. There are a lot of people in this community that understand the seriousness of this virus, but there are a lot of people here that they don't take it seriously, don't believe they can have an impact. And I think a lot of that comes from the messaging of our national leadership.
That is Steve Adler, the mayor of Austin, Texas. Mayor Adler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The James Beard Awards, which honor great chefs and restaurants, have been postponed this year due to the coronavirus. The shutdowns have hit the restaurant industry especially hard, affecting all of the people who work in it. Paola Velez is one of those people. She's the executive pastry chef at the Washington, D.C. restaurant Kith & Kin, and she's been nominated for a James Beard Award for Rising Star Chef of the Year. That's chefs 30 and under. Paola, congratulations on your nomination, and welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for congratulating me, too.
Well, and I have to ask you, as I would anybody in the restaurant industry right now, before we get to what we wanted to talk to you about, how are things going for you at this moment in the coronavirus pandemic?
Currently, I am furloughed from my job, which is fine because I've had time to really focus on the community and kind of help share things that I've been able to do for fundraising and to give to charitable causes. So we just finished this weekend doing a worldwide bake sale called Bakers mm-hmm. Against Racism. So it's been pretty fun. A friend of mine, Angel Barreto from Andrew, said that sometimes you turn poison into medicine. So we're really turning that poison into medicine.
Well, and tell me more about Bakers Against Racism. What is that?
So Bakers Against Racism is a call to action for home bakers, professional bakers, executive chefs. It's just a way to really activate and use the skills that we know how to utilize best, which is our food. And we, Willa, Chef Rob from Oyster Oyster, and I, we set these parameters for folks to kind of participate in a virtual decentralized bake sale. And we were able to raise $1.6 million wow. over the last week that went directly to organizations that are supporting and uplifting Black lives and Black communities. So it's been pretty great. I'm still trying to process everything, but I'm not letting myself kind of like stop too much to process, because then maybe COVID and everything else that's happening will catch up to me too. So I'm just moving forward, you know.
Well, and tell me, because every industry right now is taking a good look at itself and looking for racism that some people may not even have noticed existed. What is it like in the restaurant industry, which you've been in for a long time?
I will say that it's very systemic, and sometimes it's overt, right? But the way that our restaurant systems were built haven't been the kindest to people of color, predominantly Black people. And we're stepping forward. The new like guard or the new generation of chefs, we're really changing that narrative and making sure that we empower and we build from within, that we promote and hire diverse staff so that we have a very wide range of opinions when we're making decisions. And, you know, we're listening. We're trying to make sure that our non-Black Indigenous people of color friends in the industry are listening too, because if you don't care about the littlest details of somebody's life in your staff, you don't truly care about their whole being, you know. So I think that's why we're all saying Black Lives Matter now, because we really want even the tiniest bit of discomfort to be something of importance so that we can really move and change our industry and make it a better place.
Well, and tell us about your own background. You were raised in the Dominican Republic and the Bronx, right?
Yeah, I would spend the majority of the school year here in the U.S., and then I would go to the Dominican Republic And awkwardly, their school year isn't like ours. So in the summer months, I was also in school. very traumatizing for a kid who just wants a summer break. But in that, you know, I was able to see two dueling worlds, right? One that valued and was able to be sustainable, and then another one that was fast and quick and disposable. And it really taught me the importance of caring for not only things like fruits and vegetables that I use in my dishes daily, but caring about the people that are around me as well. The Dominican Republic helped me slow down enough to be able to see people and make sure that they were valuable just as much as a plated dessert.
How did you get your start as a chef? How did you get into baking?
I went to culinary school. I was working as a line cook, and I got really tired of that lifestyle very quickly. Being a line cook is coming into work at maybe noon and not leaving until 2 a.m. So I got really tired of it, and I was like, maybe I should try my hand at baking and pastry. They have a more structured schedule. You know, it's all mornings, and I think I could swing that. So I went to Jacques Torres's factory up in New York, in Brooklyn, and I just asked him for a job. I was like, I don't know a lot about chocolate, but I'm a fast learner and I listen very well, so please hire me. And he did. Wow. And he gave me my first pastry sous chef job within 4 months of joining his company. So that was fun.
And tell us about the kinds of things that you make on the Kith and Kin menu.
So in the Kith and Kin menu, I take something that's very traditional, like a rum cake, and I kind of like give it a different play. I made it a chocolate rum cake using Dominican chocolate and Puerto Rican rum. So it kind of like highlights that portion of the Caribbean, and also bringing a really big light to the chocolate industry and also the rum and sugarcane industry that kind of forced how our history was molded as West Indian folks. Then I have a plantain sticky bun with a frozen cream cheese icing that I then melt onto the sticky bun with a salted amarula caramel that's hot, like a pour over. And that one was inspired by my mom and Guy Fieri.
Wow. Wow, that's an interesting combination.
She just loves Guy Fieri. I do too. So Guy, if you're listening to this, we love you. Yeah, it just has like plantains. That's one of her favorite things to eat, sweet and savory. And I just wanted to give this kind of homage to Pennsylvania and like their pecan sticky buns, and then using like a very Caribbean item or very diasporic item like plantains and turning it into like this whole thing for my mom. She loves it. She thinks it's great.
You know, this is the moment when it's really hard to be in the midst of the pandemic, because I can't interview you in person, because if we were in person, I would really get to taste what we're talking about right here. And it sounds delicious.
Right. I think it's like a use of our imaginations now. So
what do you make of the fact that so many Americans, when faced with this major life change of the pandemic, have turned to baking on their own?
I think that it was nice. I thought it was very nice to see. I personally didn't touch flour or sugar for a month and a half because I was pretty furious that our industry was so unstable that it collapsed so quickly and there was no fail safes to protect the staff and the employees and any of the restaurants. You know, if we look at folks who have gone on unemployment, it's the majority of the restaurant industry, you know, and that's infuriating.
Well, and the alternative is that people have to go back into work and maybe put themselves at risk to open the restaurant again.
And that's also very frustrating because we're stuck between, first, we didn't understand how big this was going to be. You know, we were caught off guard. And now we are potentially taking away PPE from medical professionals that need it the most so that folks can eat at a restaurant. It's very confusing, you know. And I think that we all need to kind of stop and just think things through before we actually go through the next stages. But that's just my opinion. And probably every other restaurateur slash chef. But we'll make it do. Like, we are in an industry that is very resilient. And as you can see with Bakers Against Racism, most of us have been furloughed or have just completely lost our jobs because of a complete shutdown. But we were still able to raise so much money, and we were just so willing. Our industry is just the giving tree of industries, you know, where where the place that celebrates with you, that congratulates you, that sustains you, that makes life a little bit more comfortable for you. You know, I just wish that every other industry could see that and support us when we need them the most.
I want to just ask you one more question, which is, you know, as you we don't know when the James Beard Awards will actually be, but whenever they happen, you'll be obviously one of the nominees there for the Rising Star Chef of the Year Award. If there's a young would-be chef listening to this, especially maybe a young would-be chef of color like you, what would your one piece of advice to them be?
Right now, before the pandemic, you were going through a very gnarly experience. I'm sorry you had to go through that. During the pandemic, it seems that there's so much that you might not experience or might not get to. But don't worry. There's a lot of us that are working for you and working to make the industry a brighter place. So make sure that you keep your head high and know your worth and your value, and know that eventually people will see you, because I wish that somebody told me that when I was in the industry at first, too.
That is Paola Velez, who is the executive pastry chef at the Washington, D.C. restaurant Kith and Kin. She's been nominated for a James Beard Award for Rising Star Chef of the Year. Paola, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've been hearing a lot about how the airline industry is struggling through the pandemic, but what about other forms of transportation, like trains? In October, Amtrak will cut 20% of its staff as well as service on many of its long-haul routes outside of the Northeast Corridor. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Seth, tell us about some of the routes they're cutting.
This affects most of their network, at least when you're looking at a map, Jeremy. Routes like those that run from Seattle all the way to Chicago, or New York all the way down to New Orleans, all being cut, you know, as for when they're going to come back. An Amtrak spokeswoman told me today that their goal, at least, is to restore daily service by summer of 2021, depending, here's the asterisk, on demand.
Well, and this is something, by the way, that Amtrak has wanted to do for a while, right? We spoke with the CEO of Amtrak last year, who said that, you know, it was time to start cutting out these not profitable long haul routes.
And Amtrak now has a new CEO, just took over in April. But of course, the world has changed so much that now there are all kinds of new considerations. What's clear, though, is that things are even more difficult now for Amtrak than they were. So, you know, whether entire routes are going to disappear, that's hard to say. But hard to imagine things getting any better, relatively at least, than how they looked a few months ago.
A lot of times when they talk about cutting stations or cutting routes, members of Congress get upset about it and push back enough and say, we're going to deprive you of your money if you don't keep this route or keep this station. What kind of response are they getting?
Yeah, Amtrak does benefit sometimes from strange political bedfellows, right? Parts of the country where people might tend to be skeptical of government spending. I'm thinking of a Montana or a Nebraska, places where some of these trains pass through. Amtrak kind of shielded by the fact that some of those same people don't want to lose their Amtrak service. And Amtrak does tell me that no stations are going to close, that for now anyway, everybody's still going to have service, just in many cases, less of it.
What about the financial picture for Amtrak, the bailout money it has been requesting? What are they getting, and is it enough?
They got $1 billion as part of the CARES Act. So that was basically to get them through the next several months. They say they need another $1.5 billion on top of the $2 billion that they asked for anyway in their budget request for the coming year. So you could see there, doing the math, that that's another $2.5 billion just because of COVID that they say they need just to more or less break even, as they managed to do for the first time last year.
Right. And President Trump, we know, has long been a critic of Amtrak, proposing to cut its subsidies by half back in February. But Joe Biden rides Amtrak, loves Amtrak. I guess this coming election is sort of going to be a referendum on what happens with Amtrak.
Most definitely so. Hard to imagine two candidates with more different views about Amtrak. I mean, Biden, when he was a senator for 36 years, commuted daily between Wilmington, Delaware, and Washington, D.C. So, yeah, right. A big proponent of rail, in this case running against a big opponent. And like so many things in this country, obviously a lot riding on the results of the election. Oh,
good one. Seth Kaplan, here now, transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We've long known about the racial health divide in this country. Earlier this week, Tanya Mosley spoke with California's Surgeon General Nadine Burke-Harris, who talked about how repeated exposure to threats and violence cause permanent physiological damage in people of color. Watching the videos of the killings of George Floyd and Rayshard Brooks can cause physical illness, and she's leading an initiative to help doctors better understand that stress. Then a recent Stat article reminds us that Black and Brown Americans are more likely than whites to die from cancer or COVID-19 or to have diabetes or depression. Well, our next guest says that needs to be recognized as well. Delanor Manson, who is Black, is CEO of the Kentucky Nurses Association. In a recent editorial in several Kentucky newspapers, she said it was the association's duty to let the people of Kentucky know how nurses plan to fight the public health crisis of inequality. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org to her editorial as Delanor Manson joins us. What compelled you to write this editorial?
I saw lots of letters in the newspaper and in articles. They were just words as far as I was concerned. I kept thinking words need to be accompanied by action. Nurses always do care plans, and so that's pretty normal for us.
So you did what you know. I'm going to write a plan. Talk to us about some of the things that you are seeing on the front lines. We can say, well, for generations, people of color have not had the same access to health care that we get. But you're talking about something else as well, things that fester?
Well, first, in thinking about some of the systemic issues, the social determinants of health, including education, environment, food security, clean air, economic stability, and the statistics in Kentucky and in the nation that address diabetes, hypertension, COVID-19, but African Americans are dying at a disproportionate rate. In the state of Kentucky, our population of African Americans is about 7.9%, but yet the deaths are at 16.5%. Part of that is they're coming into the emergency rooms later because they don't have health care and they don't want to go to the doctor because they don't have money to pay for that. So we have to look at what is it that is driving the disparate healthcare outcomes.
Which also leads to, you know, health complications, because it gets to this other thing that you talk about, stress, and not just in children, but the stress in adults, being oppressed, feeling like you're targeted for violence. Talk about that illness that can have negative health impacts. Do you see that?
I feel it. I have hypertension. And part of that is from stress that you never recover from, the daily stress. I am an older American. I'm a retired naval officer, so I'm pretty healthy. But if I have daily stress where I don't get an opportunity to recover, then that could lead to the hypertension that I have. The stress comes from every day knowing that a country that I love doesn't necessarily love me, but they don't know me. So where does that come from? So that's part of the education that I think we must have as Americans, to identify what is it that makes us think that people who look different are bad, or people who look different are dangerous, or people who look different can't learn. What is it that we're learning as Americans that drive us to those thoughts? I think that we need to learn a lot more about how those thoughts come into being and then use that information to figure out what we can do to decrease the systemic racism that exists in America.
What else are you seeing within a hospital setting? Because you were calling for instance, training for nurses regarding racial disparities. Do you ever see nurses miss something because they don't know that it might be a different analysis because it's a Black person?
Oh, absolutely. Not only nurses, but doctors as well. Let's use asthma as an example. I know from studies that I have reviewed that when African-American children come into an emergency room, many times they are not provided medication to go home with or to get a prescription. And so when you ask the physicians why they might not prescribe that medication, the response was, well, they're not going to fill it anyway because they can't afford to fill it. Why would I give them a prescription for medication? Mind you, this was not a white physician. It was a African-American physician. So you're saying, well, how could that possibly be? Well, here's how it could be. Where do the students who become doctors go to school? They go to school together. They learn the same thing. So what I'm saying is that the issues that are impacting disparate health care is impacting education level. So if we don't require implicit bias training, that is what we're going to get in terms of how patients of color are treated. We need to have an understanding of what makes us different in terms of what you might see for an African American versus a Caucasian in terms of laboratory work or test results or those types of things. But I want us to go back further to find out what types of things may lead to those differences. And it means that we need to have that education in nursing schools. We also need to have elementary school and high school students to see African Americans as nurses so that they know it's a possibility that they could become a nurse as well. When I was in junior high school, my school nurse was African American. She was my cousin. So I knew if my cousin could do it, I could become a nurse.
Well, and here's the hard question. It's one thing not to know that more children of color might, you know, have an issue with asthma, or more mm-hmm. adults might have health issues because there's no fresh food in the neighborhood right. where they live. To just not know that. Mm-hmm. What about racism? I mean, do you ever see nurses or doctors not treating someone as well because they're Black?
It's a sad state to say yes, but the answer is yes. But many of these people don't even know why they're doing it. And that's when the implicit bias training comes into the picture. I don't think that we have bad people in healthcare. I think we have uninformed, uneducated people in healthcare, but we have to give them the tools to make good decisions. And we have to start with nurses in nursing school. This is an education for white people. It's education for Americans.
I'm sitting here wondering what that must be like as a nurse working in a hospital to come around a corner, seeing somebody not care for, let's say, an elderly Black person as well as you would.
Well, I've had that experience in my life with my father. The physician really felt as if my father didn't need treatment because he was an older African American, and after all, he's not going to live much longer. We went to get a second opinion, and my father's doing very, very well. But yes, I sincerely think that his initial physician did not treat him or even give him the options for treatment because he was an African-American elderly man.
Well, that's
so... Yes, that hurts.
What kind of conversations are happening among nurses?
Nursing leadership is talking about what must we do? How can we do it better? How can we do it differently? Nursing leaders are saying we are committed to not being part of this problem going forward.
Have you heard from nurses that you've worked with in the past or, you know, white nurses I'm thinking of in particular, offended by this notion that race might impact how they treat somebody? What kind of conversations are you having one-on-one?
I have only heard from one nurse, a Caucasian nurse, say to me she didn't think that this conversation would bode well for white people, that they wouldn't like it. They would think it was angry conversation. And I said, well, how is it angry to tell the truth? That's one person out of all the nurses I know. Mm-hmm. But it was said to me.
Well, we'd love to check back in with you to see how that conversation goes forward.
There are so many people who are calling for action, realizing that we must do something, that someone will sway this person. It might not be me, but there are enough people who are saying things must change, and today's a fine day to start that.
That's Delanor Manson, CEO of the Kentucky Nurses Association. We'll link you to her editorial about how the association plans to address systemic racism in health. Delanor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Doctors are now testing a potential COVID-19 treatment called convalescent plasma. The idea is that people who've recovered from the virus have antibodies to fight it in their plasma. That's the liquid part of blood. Researchers think it's possible those antibodies could help patients who are still fighting the disease. Kerry Goldberg from member station WBUR tells us about one of the first COVID patients to receive this treatment.
On Sunday, April 19th, with COVID-19 ravaging his lungs, Dr. Nick Athanides had a tube inserted down his throat and was hooked up to a ventilator at Tufts Medical Center in Boston. He was sedated and restrained. He says it felt surreal.
You're locked in. You can't move. You can't see. And you can't move your head. And you know you're alive. But you can't do anything.
He could still think, though, and he loves numbers. So Dr. Athanides did the math.
And I says, okay, I intubated, and I am close to 60, male, diabetic. So my chances of getting out of here is less than 10%.
But he decided he would beat the odds.
And I said, with the help of science, my family, and God, I'm going to walk out of here.
And he did. The science part was the very cutting edge of COVID-19 treatment. Tufts Medical Center enrolled him in a trial of a drug called tocilizumab that seems to calm the immune system. And he would soon get the promising antiviral drug remdesivir. His wife, Jennifer, also wanted him to get convalescent plasma, an experimental treatment from the blood of recovered patients.
That's when I decided to go to social media, hoping to find a donor. The American Red Cross said if you do find a donor, then you're more likely to get that plasma than just applying directly for the plasma.
She posted an appeal on Facebook, and the response was overwhelming. Calls and messages 24 hours a day, even as she was coming down with a milder case of the virus. Dr. Athanides is a longtime kidney specialist who treats many low-income and older patients south of Boston. They and their families were among the well-wishers and would-be donors. It was an outpouring of goodwill. But Dr. Athanides was sinking fast, and Jennifer says all that goodwill couldn't translate into immediate help.
The problem was, it's like a good 5 days, which I didn't realize, to actually find somebody, get them tested, make sure they're a good candidate, and all of that.
Fortunately, plasma already in storage at the Rhode Island Blood Bank came through. Within a couple of days of getting it and the antiviral drug remdesivir, Dr. Athanides began to get better. He was soon well enough to be weaned off the ventilator and leave the ICU. Just 17 days after he was admitted to the hospital, he climbed the front steps of his house, alone, with a lot of help from the handrail. So how much credit does the convalescent plasma deserve for that victorious homecoming?
This is the $64,000 question.
Dr. Andreas Klein oversees the convalescent plasma program at Tufts Medical Center. And he says, at this point, we just don't know. He says the plasma does seem to be safe, and plenty of doctors on the front lines have stories about patients like Dr. Athanides who get convalescent plasma and then get better. But they're not simple stories because these are very sick patients getting multiple treatments.
It's a full court press, all hands on deck. and we're doing many, many things at once to help individual patients. And so it's hard to tease apart what the contribution of one thing versus another is.
He says only rigorous clinical trials of convalescent plasma can do that. Dr. Cliff Lane from the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases agrees. He says studies on convalescent plasma for flu didn't find much benefit, but the treatment did work against a virus called Argentine hemorrhagic fever. So he says, in theory, the plasma could help, and patients and doctors may choose to try it.
But I can't say that, yes, this is something that definitely should be used. I would have to say there's really insufficient data to recommend it one way or the other.
Clinical trials of convalescent plasma are now getting underway. Dr. Klein from Tufts expects COVID-19 convalescent plasma treatment to evolve rapidly. Right now, one donation helps one or two or three patients. Soon, he expects to have pooled plasma from multiple donors, a more concentrated and possibly more potent product that's treated more like a typical drug.
And that's going to probably happen as we go into the summer. So there'll be even more opportunities for people to donate plasma sort of as we go on.
Among the people who'll be donating are Jennifer and Nick Athanides. This month, they hope.
Every day, stronger, my endurance, and just the ability to do something without needing oxygen.
He may never know for sure, but he does believe the convalescent plasma, combined with all the other treatments he received, helped him beat the odds. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.